Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Remember how Laker fans were feeling it yesterday? Remember how we got into this? Remember how fired up they were after this went down in Denver?
On its way, does not go down. Oh, the Caruso! The final slam!
Remember that. Now, I'm not somebody to do the same show 2 days in a row. I would never do that. But remember how yesterday was just a bad day for Laker haters because they had to listen to Laker fans crack back on them over that rap that they had not played anybody, that they had not done anything, that they had this lame schedule strength. Remember that. Laker haters knew that they had something coming last night. They didn't like it yesterday, but they knew that Laker fan had something coming last night. Laker haters knew that the Lakers had to go back-to-back, Denver and then to Utah. So they were going to get their comeuppance at Utah. They were going to get theirs at Utah. Face it, Denver to Utah is a rough trip, especially the way the Jazz can defend. So Laker hater knew to stay down after the Lakers beat the Denver Nuggets because what could they say? But they also knew last night the Lakers were going to lie down. And then they could come right back up in here and snap flags off Laker fans' rig and talk all their junk. Because while the Lakers may have beaten the Nuggets, they were about to get locked up by the Jazz. Right? Excuse me, my bad. LA 121, Utah 96. A second game of the back-to-back beatdown. L.A. rolls into town. They hammer the Jazz. They take off their shoes. And they piss off the Jazz announcers, which I will get to in a minute. But let me say this once again. It is very tough to make a statement in December, to have a statement win in December. But going on the road to beat Denver and Utah on back-to-back nights is about as close to a statement as you're going to get. Strength of schedule. Try this. Try this 25-point blowout in Utah on for size. A game in which they were able to get a ton of rest as well. Neither LeBron nor AD played more than 29 minutes. And it was not just that they won, it was how they won. Pushing the pace on offense, which is crazy considering it is back-to-back. And here's the other thing about the Lakers that nobody thought was possible. The defense. I'll get to some of the highlights in a moment, but remember the defense. Remember when Frank Vogel came in and everybody clowned that decision and said that it made no sense whatsoever and was the epitome of the dysfunctional Lakers. Who's clowning it now? Vogel is the Western Conference Coach of the Month. Vogel is the front runner for NBA Coach of the Year because he doesn't just have them playing defense. He's got them playing elite defense. And doing it with energy and aggression. The fact that everybody's locked in defensively and on the same page defensively this early is amazing. I mean, really a testament to Vogel as a coach. And yes, it does help when you've got Anthony Davis playing at a defensive player of the year level and doing things like this.
To the rim. Bogdanovic, fly-by by Davis. Then he comes back and deflects it. What a play by AD.
Spectrum Sportsnet. That's not really fair. A big is not supposed to be able to close out like that, fly by like that, and then recover like that. This guy will guard whoever you have, and there's a really good chance he will shut them down. Ask Denver. Now you can ask Utah. And if we're talking about AD as the DPOY, you may as well just consider him for the MVP as well because he's also doing things like this.
Good pass to Davis, who throws it down with one hand, assist to LeBron.
Things like that and things like this.
AD drives, spins to the rim and dunks it. Wow. A major league move by Anthony Davis.
That was nice.
Split the double team with a spin move, dunk on a third guy. 60% of the Utah players on the court had a chance to stop that guy, and none of them could. No wonder Rajon Rondo is saying stuff like, I got him as MVP and Defensive Player of the Year, so if he only gets one, I'll be pissed. End quote. Same, R2. Same. And don't sleep on the work that LeBron is doing either. He went for 20 points, 12 assists, and the best travel ever. Yes, Laker haters, that is about the only thing that you can hang your hat on after last night. That LeBron took, like, I don't know, 4 or 10 steps and didn't get called for it. But then again, he's about as shocked as you are that that happened and that there was no call.
Yeah, it was the worst thing I ever, probably one of the worst things I've ever done in my career. I didn't even realize I did it until halftime, to be honest. One of my coaches showed me. I didn't even realize I did it. I think at the same time, I was watching the underneath play, and KCP and Donovan got into it. KCP started to run, and then Donovan bumped into him. He fell on the ground, and I think I was ready to pass the ball, and my brain just kind of just, I just had a malfunction. I really had a malfunction. So, you know, I feel bad for the refs on that one because, you know, they probably get a write-up on that one. That was pretty bad.
It's pretty hilarious how much time he takes to break that down. It's like the ball was inbounded to him, and then he just walked it up the floor. And when I say walk it up the floor, I don't mean like dribbled it up the floor. I mean like he carried the ball up the floor. Took about 30 steps. Oh yeah, that's right. I'm supposed to dribble. It was that bad, but that hilarious. Almost as hilarious is what happened near the end of the game with LeBron. But again, before we get to that, one more highlight. Because that's what this Lakers team is. It's a highlight factory. You had Alex Caruso, the bald mamba, doing this in Denver Tuesday night.
On its way, does not go down. Oh, the Caruso!
That was awesome. But I'm not sure it was as good as this. This being Dwight Howard doing this to Utah last night.
Dwight's going to shoot a three.
It's on its way, and down it goes! Dwight Howard, that's his 7th 3 in his career.
It was nothing but net, too. Splash.
Look at Boogie.
Can I tell you something? That's not just Dwight Howard shooting a three. That's not just Dwight Howard hitting a three. That's Dwight Howard hitting a jab step three, which is elite and unreal. And the continued transformation of Dwight Howard over the past few months is still one of the most stunning things I have ever seen in my life. But if you want to talk about stunning things, the Utah Jazz announcers damn near lost their minds when Kyle Kuzma had back-to-back blocks and LeBron started to celebrate.
Big fella turns in a crowd, continues to fight, blocked again.
Look at LeBron, he's on the court
with no shoes, mind you.
Oh, what is going on here?
That's some disrespect right there. Please. This isn't playground ball.
Please. I mean, they are clowning right now on that bench side.
Right. They are. You hear that? You would have thought that LeBron had come onto their court and stomped all over the Utah logo. Or that LeBron went onto their court and went Randy Moss moon with it.
Moss! Randy Moss is in for a touchdown!
Randy Moss, without even really being able to run, as he shoots the moon to the fans here in Green Bay.
That is a disgusting act by Randy Moss. And it's unfortunate that we had that on our air live. That is disgusting by Randy Moss.
Like, that is a disgusting act by LeBron James. And it is unfortunate that we had that on our air live. That is disgusting by LeBron James. Wait, so your beef is what? Your beef is that he's not wearing shoes? Like, what kind of a weird issue is that? He's disrespecting the game with that? Get out of here with that. Hey, yo, fellas, he took off his shoes and he gave them to some kids. Shouldn't he be applauding that gesture instead of killing him for it? Man, those dudes were worked up. I thought the Jazz broadcasters were going to go Lamar Thomas on that. I thought they were going to go down the elevator and get in that thing.
And that's what I'm talking about. You come into our house, you should get your behind kicked. You don't come in the OB playing that stuff. You're across the ocean over there. You're across the city. You can't come over to our place talking noise like that. You get your butt beat. I was about to go down the elevator and get in that thing.
I was about to go down the elevator and get in that thing. I haven't heard a broadcaster that bent out of shape over anything insignificant since Mike Patrick was getting all worked up over Britney Spears.
I have an important question.
Go ahead.
What is Britney doing with her life?
Who?
Britney.
Britney who?
Spears. What is she doing with her career?
Why do we care at this point? Is she here?
I don't think so.
Georgia from the 25.
Yo, fellas, it's a game, and a game your team was losing by 20 at that point. So if you want to be pissed about anything, be pissed about that, because LeBron did not disrespect you or the game or your fans. Somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose, and we all love the feeling of winning, especially this time of year. And if you're giving everybody Bombas socks this holiday, you deserve a spot in the Holiday Gifting Hall of Fame. First ballot, you go right in. Let's waive the mandatory 5-year waiting period. Hey, did you know that socks are the number one most requested item in homeless shelters? Bombas socks were created to change that. That's true, because for every pair you buy, Bombas donates a pair to somebody in need. Bombas socks are amazing. They're soft, not pretty soft, more like made with the softest cotton in the history of the world, soft. And you do a lot of different things, right? So Bombas has made a lot of different socks, like dress socks for work, performance socks for working out, even limited edition holiday socks. So you know that person who's just a gift enigma, impossible to shop for, you never know what to get them? Bombas is the gift that even that person is going to love. Everybody will. So what you want to do is go to bombas.com/Rome. Get 20% off any purchase during their big holiday sale. November 18th through December 5th. That's bombas.com/Rome. Get 20% off. I'm telling you, I love these socks. I love the company. I love the mission behind the company. bombas.com/Rome. Logan Ryan is my guest. Logan, good to have you on. How are you?
What's going on, Jim? Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Great to have you. All right, so let me ask you about Sunday's game. You guys had heard all the noise, Logan, about the fact that this organization had won only one game in Indianapolis since they had built that new stadium. So what was your mindset going into that game?
I don't really think we cared. You know, a lot of these players nowadays are younger to this league, newer players, or I'm somebody who's only been here 3 years. I'm 2-1 in that stadium. So it really had nothing to say about that. I know it's quiet. We call it church on Sunday there because the crowd's really quiet. That's how Peyton Manning used to like it. But, you know, we're taking on Jacoby Brissett and the Colts, and they were banged up, and we actually had a lot of injuries too, and it was just a battle. And we got a lot of respect for the organization. I think Frank Wright is a really good coach. I think he's one of the best in the NFL. They have great scheme, and they have a good offensive line. They run the ball, and they play physical and play hard. But we run the ball, we play physical and play hard too. So it was strength on strength.
Logan Ryan joining us. All right, so a couple of moments from that game that I want to hit on. Like when you came off the edge and you drilled Jacoby Brissett as he got the ball off, you were mic'd up in the game and you said, "That one hurt, that one hurt. I know it hurt you," end quote. I love how you were talking in the game because you frequently were just planting ideas in your opponent's heads. You know, like that one hurt or you're going to fumble. What's your strategy when it comes to that, and how do guys respond when you're talking to them like that?
You know, I completely forget that I'm mic'd up, and I say a lot more stuff than that. That's just the stuff that makes it on air.
Right.
So people are surprised because they see me off the field, and I'm very, you know, I love the animal rescue, philanthropy, and pretty much all around solid guy, married, family man. But, you know, on the field, I'm trying to win. And Jacoby was a teammate of mine in New England for some years. So I've known him since his first year coming in. And he was a scout team quarterback. And, you know, he was going against our defense every day. So there was a lot of trash talk between the two. And, there, you know, I'm really proud of him. I'm proud of the way he's doing in Indy. But I know when I hurt Jacoby, and that one hurt him. I hit him right in his – I felt the wind get out of him. So I let him know it hurts. And I tell the running backs all the time, you're going to fumble. I tell the receivers, you can't get open. You know, it's talking me up. It's putting doubt in their head, whatever it's doing. But I know when I'm talking like that, I'm on top of my game.
We're talking to Logan Ryan. All right, so then the score is tied at 17 going into the fourth. There's that block field goal return for a TD that gave you a 24-17 lead. And then two plays after that, you picked off your former teammate. Take me through that play. What did you see on that play, and how good did it feel to get that huge turnover?
It felt great. You know, I've been around the ball a lot this year and been working really hard and put a lot of work in this year, working on the jug machines, catching the ball, doing a whole bunch of extra stuff that, you know, only I know. And, you know, we were in a defense that was a zone that looked like man, and I kind of saw Pascal kind of running down the field on our backer, and I kind of knew that that's the matchup Jacoby wanted. Jacoby's a really smart quarterback, but I kind of know what he likes and what he wants. I knew he was going there, and our linebacker, Rashawn Evans, did a great job of making the ball sail a little bit, and I was on the spot, just trusting my instincts and going with it. It was a great call. and it was a great play by Rashawn and our pass rush. So, you know, it's a team sport, and all these plays are made by the team. It's not just me out there. So a lot of credit goes to Rashawn and the team on that one.
Logan Ryan joining us. Listen, we may not know exactly what you're doing and all the work you're putting in, but it's pretty clear to anybody who watches you play that you like to hit, and you like to hit hard. The rap has always been the corner shy away from contact. What is your approach to hitting guys the way you do and your physical style of play?
I want to win, man. And ever since you played football when you were little, my dad was my defensive coordinator when I was 6 years old. He said, just go tackle the guy with the ball. So I don't really believe in corners, you know, not throwing their stuff in there or not trying to avoid tackles or trying to, you know, preserve themselves, whatever you want to call it. It's football. And I feel like if you tackle right, tackle the correct way, it's safe. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to help my team win. And the league's changing. We see all these spread offenses. We see all these RPOs. We see all this college stuff coming to the games, faster players, more versatile players. Well, defenses are changing as well. And I think I'm one of the guys that's helping that. And do I play nickel? Do I play safety? Do I play corner? You know, I'm making plays at deep half. I'm blitzing a lot. I'm making a lot of tackles. And then, so I really just feel like the football is changing, and I'm one of those players that the team's putting some stuff on my plate that's different from week to week. And all I can do is study it and try to make plays for the team and do whatever it's asked. And guys like Charles Woodson and Rondae Barber and guys like that are some of my favorite players, some of the best DBs to play, and those are guys I model my game after.
Well, and on top of that, you're getting a lot of attention because of your play, because of the numbers you're putting up. I know you're focused on team goals, but what does it mean to you that people want to see you in the Pro Bowl and are talking about that possibility?
You know, it's a great honor. It would be a great honor. I haven't had one. There was years where people said I should have, but I really didn't matter. The Pro Bowl would mean a lot just for my family. I have two young kids. I take them to Disney and have that moment with them. I mean, I take them to Disney all the time. I just pay for it. So on the house would be great. But you know, that stuff's really more for my family to get excited. I know that if I'm playing hard and if I'm in good shape, and playing the right way, that the numbers and all that stuff will come. I can't control it. I just want to help my team win games, and all that stuff will you know, take control in the end. So I'll be honored for my family and everything like that. And I'm proud that the fans and the football fans are watching me and, you know, like my game. But, you know, I go out there. I really don't chase the numbers, man. I go out there and just try to do whatever it takes to win.
Logan Ryan joining me for another few moments. You know, you mentioned this off the top, and I was going to get to it no matter what. But as some people know, you founded the Ryan Animal Rescue Foundation, and it's a cause that is really close to your heart and very important to you. How did you first get involved in animal welfare issues?
My wife, my girlfriend at the time, she was my college sweetheart. When I got up to New England in 2013, you know, I was playing and I was working a lot, and she was a former college athlete, and she was trying to transition and bounce around a couple of jobs trying to figure out what she did and wanted to do. And she said, I'm just going to go work at an animal shelter. And she started working at an animal shelter for minimum wage. And nobody knew that, you know, she was dating an NFL player. That's not how she is. And she was sweeping kennels and picking up after dogs and walking them like a lot of people do, and with a huge heart. And I started to go visit on my off days and started seeing these animals and seeing the issues. And I said, man, I got to use my platform and my awareness to do something about it. So I started taking pictures with some of those dogs who were there, and cats and kittens, and on the 26th of every month, and getting them adopted. And it was called the Ryan Monthly Rescue, just featuring some of these animals on my Instagram. And that grew and blossomed into a full 501c3 nonprofit that's been running for up to about 3 years now. And raised well over $100,000, donated well over $100,000 of my own money. And we do a lot to raise awareness, provide grants, education programs to help shelters, help volunteers, and help these animals, help them get adopted, help them find homes, pay for spay and vaccine clinics. So we do all types of stuff. But it's close to my heart because my wife and I, we have three rescue animals. She worked in the shelter. And it's something that I feel like I could be a voice of the voiceless. And obviously, my calls, my cleats is coming up. I'll be wearing them week 15, and I'll have some bright neon cleats and auction them off for my charity to help these shelter animals get adopted.
That is so great. There's got to be so much pride in that. So before you go, you mentioned three rescue animals. We have a rescue cat that's absolutely amazing. What are your three rescue animals?
So I have a dog that me and my wife got in college, a puggle named Nala. I have a big blue pitty. As intimidating and as big and large head as ever, and the sweetest guy in the world, my kid's favorite named Leonardo, named after the Blue Ninja Turtle. And then we just rescued a blind senior pity about 2 years ago. His name's Julius. He's 11 years old, completely blind, no eyes. So we have one that's, you know, they're all special known, right? He's super special because of that. And then my four-year-old daughter is getting into fostering some kittens. So we've been bringing some foster kittens in there that she's been help feeding and learning responsibility and giving them back when they're ready to get adopted. So we got all types of animals in my house, all rescues. I believe that everybody's animals in a shelter looking for a second chance, looking for a forever home. And I have two young kids, and they're learning how to have a great heart because of these animals.
That is so great. He is a two-time Super Bowl champ, an All-American out of Rutgers. Tennessee is 7-5. They're second in the AFC South. Another big one on Sunday against Oakland. Logan Ryan. Dude, I don't know how you and I did not do this sooner. It was so good to have you on the show, Logan. I really appreciate you. Great job.
Appreciate it, Jim. Thank you.
Today's episode of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by CBS Sports HQ, the brand new streaming sports news network. It is live 24/7, and you know what it costs you? Nothing at all. That's right. Sports coverage that's always on and always free. I love it. Not manufactured, hyped, contrived debate, but sports coverage that's straight and free with the best intel. CBS Sports HQ has coverage which is always focused on the game, lots of highlights, breaking news as it happens, fantasy advice, and something we all care about and need, gambling picks, analysis to get you that extra edge. I know, for instance, when I turn on to CBS Sports HQ, I'm going to see the tips and the trends that I need to win my bets. And don't forget, you get access to all this amazing coverage free. I don't mean free for a week or a month, or you have to have some sort of special cable package. I mean totally and completely free for everybody. You don't even need a login. Just download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, or any other connected device at any time and watch CBS Sports HQ. No fake debates, just sports for real sports fans at the great price of zero. You don't have to log in. You don't have to sign up for anything. Download the CBS Sports app and watch CBS Sports HQ today. Chris Mannix is my guest. Chris, what's up? How are you?
How do you follow the athlete, Jim, that's extremely comfortable and good on the air? That's a tough act to follow, man.
Yeah, but you are an extremely comfortable broadcaster, writer, and podcaster. Also on the air, and when you're done playing, you're going to walk off and do whatever you want, so you can do it. I got you. Listen, Chris, you're on the call for Ruiz Joshua 2 on Saturday. Before we get to the fight, which I love, exactly where in the world are you right now, and what is the scene like?
I am in my hotel room in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. It's the location that was chosen by Anthony Joshua, who had pretty much total control over where the rematch would be by virtue of the initial contract. Saudi Arabia stepped up and made an offer north of $50 million, $50 million, to host this fight. And, you know, Anthony Joshua followed the money. What Saudi has done in the last 2 months has quite literally built a stadium, a 15 to 20,000 seat stadium, for this fight to take place. It's open air. The temperature is in the, you know, low to mid 70s right now in Saudi Arabia. I can't speak too much about the atmosphere. I think a lot of people are going to be coming in on visas on fight night. They expect about 4,000 to 5,000 British fans to be in attendance, but it certainly is a fascinating place to hold a big fight. And I think, no question, the biggest fight that we've ever seen in this region.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. Now, you and I spoke after the first fight. When you look back on that fight, Chris, what were your expectations for the fight going into it?
Oh, I thought that Joshua would just steamroll Andy Ruiz. I mean, Ruiz has been a good fighter throughout his career, but in his toughest test to date, he lost to Joseph Parker. It was a close fight, but he lost. He took that fight effectively on 5-6 weeks' notice. I didn't think he'd be too significant a threat, but Andy Ruiz showed a lot in that fight. And I think more than anything, Anthony Joshua showed weaknesses. I think he didn't take Ruiz as seriously as he should have. And throughout his career, Jim, he's been known as a guy that's been a little bit chinny. He was knocked down by Vladimir Klitschko in their fight in 2017. No shame there. Vladimir Klitschko is a terrific puncher. But he was also buckled early on in the fight against Alexander Povetkin. He's been hit, you know, pretty regularly. Doesn't fight like a traditional big man in the mold of a Lennox Lewis or a Vladimir Klitschko. So he's not, you know, he's not perfect out there in the ring. And Andy Ruiz exposed a lot of that. I think a lot of people are wondering what kind of adjustments Anthony Joshua is going to make.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. So really quickly then, when you look back on that right now, does that fight feel even more incredible, or does it feel like, you know what, it actually makes some sense?
You know, I guess it makes more sense in hindsight. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the last few months talking to, you know, more people that have been around Andy Ruiz, not just his training staff, but, you know, people in his former promoter, Top Rank. I mean, they had him for a number of years, got him right out of the amateur ranks. And Andy Ruiz is a guy that has a pretty good amateur background. He only has that one loss. You know, Top Rank parted ways with him, not because they didn't believe in his talent, but because they didn't think he would ever take boxing as seriously as he needed to, as it needed to be. So, in hindsight, you can certainly see that Andy Ruiz was more viable than he initially was given credit for.
Chris Mannix is joining us. Now, you recently went to England and you sat down with Joshua. It's one thing to lose, but Joshua told you, quote, "I just had to deal with the pain and the issues of taking a loss against what people called a fat guy," end quote. How much do you think that Ruiz's physical appearance added to the pain of that loss?
Oh, I think it absolutely did. Look, fighters have different mentalities than media members. They know that appearances can be deceiving, and Anthony Joshua didn't go into that fight thinking Ruiz was, you know, the equivalent of a modern-day Butterbean. Like, he knew he was a real fighter, but I don't think that he took him as seriously as maybe he would have taken Jarrell Miller, the original opponent who had to back out after testing positive for banned substances less than 2 months before that fight. So I do think that Anthony Joshua saw Ruiz and saw a softer target in Ruiz, and the fact that he lost to him and has had to take such heated criticism. I mean, I wrote in the magazine this week, Jim, that, you know, like, Anthony Joshua is the first fighter, and certainly the first heavyweight, to lose in the Twitter age. So not only did he lose to a guy that was viewed at as inferior in the same way that Mike Tyson did and Lennox Lewis did, but he had to deal with the barbs. And Anthony Joshua is a huge social media presence. He's got millions of followers on Instagram, on Twitter, on YouTube. I mean, he's everywhere on social media. So he not only had to deal with the loss, but every day, if you ever logged on to his accounts, having people say just a lot of stuff about him. And I think that stuck with him as well.
Chris Mannix is joining us. So, Chris, in the aftermath of that fight, there were so many different theories and attempts to explain what happened to Joshua. Like, he just wasn't focused. He's overrated. He even had a panic attack. What do you make of all those theories?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that. I don't believe he had a panic attack. I've spoken to a number of people about that, and that seems like it's more just sort of internet-driven gossip. Is he overrated? I don't really believe that either, because prior to this, it wasn't like he was a guy that was a paper champion. I mean, he had wins over the likes of Dillian White, of course, Vladimir Klitschko. Joseph Parker was an undefeated champion when he faced Joshua, so he had some significant wins leading into that fight. I just think he had a really bad night, and could that night be duplicated? I mean, Joshua said to me, you know, maybe it's possible that Ruiz has his number. I think that's possible, but I think it's equally possible, if not more likely, that this fight, the first fight, goes down just like, you know, Lewis versus Rahman. Remember, in that fight back in 2001, Lewis avenged that loss just months later in a spectacular knockout. Vladimir Klitschko himself lost to a guy named Lehman Brewster, was knocked out, and a year or so later, he beat Brewster in a rematch, knocking him out. So I think that history shows that a guy can have a bad night and rebound spectacularly, and there are a lot of people around Anthony Joshua that firmly believe that's going
to
happen.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. There is a history of guys pulling off stunning upsets in boxing and then not winning that rematch. Now, you were with Ruiz in the fighter meetings about 24 hours ago. He was there rocking a Knicks jersey. What was your sense of his mindset and his mood right now?
I mean, it's funny, Jim, like, Andy Ruiz, even though he's got the titles, still looks like that kind of fan off the street that pays money to take a picture with the heavyweight champion. I mean, seeing them at the press conference, I mean, Ruiz has got that, you know, big Derrick Rose jersey that he bought on the day of the first fight, and he wore it to the post-fight press conference. He doesn't look like a, a real fighter, certainly not standing next to the Greek god that is Anthony Joshua, but you know, clearly he is. Now, you asked about the mindset. I think it's a good question, and I don't think it's one we can fully answer until after the fight. I have my doubts that he's as sort of hungry for this fight as he was for the first one. As I mentioned, you know, talking to his former promoter, one thing that comes back to me a lot is that time has never been the friend of Andy Ruiz. When he's been active, he's been able to stay sharp, stay relatively in shape, stay focused. But when he takes time off, has longer layoffs, that tends to be problematic for him. It tends to keep him out of the gym and less focused. So right now, they're saying all the right things. He talked to his trainer, Manny Robles, says he's been in training camp for like 3 months. Doc Andy, he's just as hungry, just as focused as the last time. But he's been celebrated in his hometown. He's been built up and praised like never before. He came into the fighter meetings wearing, like, clearly new jewelry, new ring, new necklace. He probably had $100,000 around his neck and on his fingers, you know, going into that meeting. So I do wonder if, you know, all this, all the trappings of success may have cost him a little bit of something, and if it did, that could significantly change the fight.
We're going to find out this weekend. All right, before I let you go, I've got to hit you with a quick basketball question. You recently weighed in on whether James Harden is the best scorer in NBA history. How do you go about answering that question, Chris?
It's so subjective, and, you know, look, do I believe that Michael Jordan, if you dropped him into today's game with today's rules, where you can't manhandle him like, you know, the Pistons and the Knicks and all those teams did back in the 1990s, I think he'd be putting up James Harden-like numbers. But the fact is, we can't do that. We can't just put Jordan in today's game. In today's game, in today's rules, James Harden is the most unstoppable offensive player that I've ever seen. He's incredible with his body control. He's incredible with the three-point shot. And he does things. One of the reasons I tilt towards yes with this answer is that he does things oftentimes with the entirety of an opposing defense aimed at him. I mean, you talk to rival coaches, especially the last couple of years when Harden hasn't had as much offensive support as maybe he has this year with Russell Westbrook, they just gear their entire defense toward him. He's looking at one guy. He's got two guys behind that guy designed there to stop him from dribble penetration, and he still gets to the hole, and he still makes plays. And that, to me, is nothing short of remarkable. So I think he has a very strong argument to be called the greatest scorer in NBA history.
All right, so quickly, in today's game, with today's rules, if you're a defense, how do you go about trying to stop him or at least limiting his impact?
I wish I knew. I mean, he's so comfortable from three. When he gets to the basket, the way he uses that body and extends his arms, he's almost guaranteed to get to the free throw line. He's averaging 14 free throws per game this year, Jim. It's incredible. That's a career high for James Harden. I just think you have to try to force him into a mid-range game. And because the mid-range shot, as we know, the least efficient shot in basketball, if you can force him to long twos, great. He's probably still going to make them, but that's the best you can do.
Once again, Ruiz, Joshua 2, Saturday, 3:45 p.m. Eastern on DAZN. He's an NBA writer for SI, an NBA analyst for NBC Sports Boston, and a boxing analyst for DAZN, and hosts a couple of podcasts as well. Chris Mannix, my guest. Chris, great job. You see, I knew there was no issue with you following a guy who's comfortable, who can walk off the field and do whatever he wants when he's done. Great job, Chris. Have a great weekend.
You got it, Jim. Thanks.
After a number of days of, like, weird speculation about the future of Clay Helton, USC AD Mike Bonn tweeted out the following news yesterday. Quote, "I am pleased to let you know Coach Helton will continue to be our head coach. His commitment to our student athletes and to leading with integrity is vital to restoring our championship program, which is the goal for all of our teams." End quote. And then the response. Let's just say the response was, well, it was not great. Never a good sign when your coaching announcement via tweet gets ratioed into oblivion. And especially when it's happening for the second year in a row. Because it was roughly this time last year when USC announced that Helton was coming back after a loss to Notre Dame. And it was greeted with the same amount of rage. This time, Bonn was not the only one hearing about it. USC president Carol Folt tweeted out a photo and a congratulatory message. She tweeted, "What an honor to present Emeritus Professor Victor Webb with the Robert Biller Service Award for 10 years of work with the First Gen Caldwell Scholars. Very special to celebrate him with the family of Russell Caldwell, who founded the program, end quote. And that tweet about an honor for an emeritus professor was greeted with replies like this, quote, "That's awesome. Now please fire clueless Clay Helton and make USC a respectable football program again," end quote. Also, responses like this, quote, "What a great honor. But the greatest honor of all would be to hashtag fire Helton, hashtag hire Meyer to get the program right. And so the school would not lose millions of dollars when the big time alumni don't back the school if Helton is still coach," end quote. And then this one, which cuts right to the chase, quote, "What is the holdup? Fire Helton already," end quote. It seems to me like a pretty strong reaction, a pretty strong negative reaction to a head coach who lost his starting quarterback and still managed to win 8 games with a freshman backup who was overlooked by everybody and now looks like the real deal. Oh, and he lost his backup for a stretch and had to go at the backup to the backup and still managed to have a look at winning that division. And is now going into next season with what might be a really exciting competitive quarterback battle. Normally getting 8 wins out of a season, not only a season, but a season like that. Normally getting 8 wins is a reason to party and not a reason to riot. Except USC fan is pissed. Like really, really pissed. And he's pissed because he thought that a change was going to be made this time. Like USC fan had these visions of Urban Meyer dancing in their heads, or even James Franklin. Except now they're getting Clay Helton again. And it's the second year in a row they've been told that they're going to run it back with Clay Helton. And now they're raging. They want blood. They want somebody's head on a stick. They're looking to go on Twitter. Fight on has become fight me. It's a reason to go because they brought that guy back. Because for a while now, they had convinced themselves that somebody else was coming. And that somebody else might be Herb himself. You know, like old Herb was going to come down from the broadcast set, jump on Traveler, ride to midfield, smash a sword into the ground, wave around some letter from his kids about his newest round of promises and the contract they made him sign, and then start ripping off Rose Bowls. That's what Trojan fan thought. But if you've been thinking that, you've been begging because Urban Meyer was not happening. Either USC did not want Herb, or Herb did not want USC, or neither wanted each other. But for weeks, all the signs were pointing to him not coming. And if you thought that he was, you had not been reading the vibes. You were just living in some sort of fantasy world, some sort of fantasy land, Trojan fan. And that fantasy got blown up yesterday. Here's the other part of fantasy land. The other part the Trojan fan either didn't know or didn't want to pay attention to. According to Yahoo Sports, it was going to cost USC something in the neighborhood of $20 million to buy out Clay Helton and his staff. You can go thank Lynn Swan for that. 20 mil. And then you'd need money on top of that 20 mil to get that big name head coach you wanted. It's a lot of money, even for the filthy rich, even for the super rich at USC. And by the way, how do you think those people got filthy rich? How do you think they got super rich in the first place? By not lighting millions of dollars on fire. That's how. How many boosters were willing to write that kind of a check to a guy to have him not coach? And then come up with another fat check for a guy who will coach? So you got your guy. Same as he ever was. Like, Clay Helton's a really good dude. He's a really good dude and a pretty good coach. But USC fan clearly does not like him and probably never will, no matter what he does. And the fact that Coach O is doing what he's doing at LSU right now makes it burn even worse because they had this guy. They had Coach O, and he really wanted them, and they wanted nothing to do with him, and they passed him over. And look what he's doing now at LSU. I'm not saying that Clay Helton is the next Pete Carroll. He's not perfect, but he's good. He's good. And right now, good is really good, because there's one more thing, Trojan fan, that you're ignoring. I hate to break this to you, Trojan fan, but your school has lurched from one scandal to another. The athletic department alone has been involved with two separate federal investigations. The feds are involved. The fallout from that is still ongoing. And you want to bring in Urban Meyer into that situation. Yeah, because that's an awesome idea. We've got two federal investigations. Why don't we see if we can get the hat trick? Let's bring old Urban so he can dump a bunch of gasoline on that existing dumpster fire. Look, I know getting blown out by Oregon didn't feel good at all. I know the recruiting rankings do not look that good. I know the issues with discipline on the field are a concern, and the empty seats at the Coliseum are a bad look. But the only reason you're upset now is because you got your hopes up despite all the evidence to the contrary. That's on you. That's not on Helton. That's not on the new AD. That's not on the president. That's on you. Because if you had been paying any attention, you would have known that this was going to go down like this, that Herb was not coming, that James Franklin was not coming. They were not going to break Helton off, not right now, and especially not at that cost. How did you not know that, Trojan fan? How did you let yourself believe that something else was going to happen? Trojan fan, Aunt Becky and her friends ain't walking through those doors with any fat checks anymore. Deal with that, Trojan fan. Aunt Becky ain't coming back. Not with her stacks, not with her rich friends. Contractors everywhere rely on Ferguson for a wide variety of specialty products, tools, supplies, and services. Access all this and more with a new Ferguson app. It allows you to order on the go, find your nearest location, and quickly scan product barcodes for easy reordering. And with tools like this, it is no wonder why ordering with Ferguson is the easiest part of your hard day's work. So download today and get started with Ferguson. Dana White. Dana, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great, buddy. How are you?
Good, man. I'm good, Dana. All right, so really quickly, let me jump into it because I know our time is short. You've got Overeem fighting Rozenstruik, and a lot of fans are familiar with Overeem, but they're not as familiar with his opponent who stepped in on short notice. He's won three times this year. None of his fights have gone longer than 59 seconds. What do you make of what you've seen from him over the past 12 months?
Yeah, no, these guys are both obviously massive heavyweights, big, huge monsters. In the main event, Rozenstruik is undefeated, 9-0, and 8 of his 9 wins are by knockout. And Alistair Overeem has fought everybody in the business, you know, a true vet of the game. And, you know, this is one of those fights. You know, the big name, the guy who's been around forever, Alistair Overeem, who is currently ranked number 6 in the world, taking on, the, you know, the up-and-coming, you know, young savage, I guess I would say. And, you know, obviously if Alistair Overeem wins this fight, he can continue his climb to try to take another run at a title shot. And if not, then Rozenstruik is in the mix in the top 10 and on his way, you know, hopefully for a title shot.
We're talking to Dana White, so that's a great matchup. Both guys have a lot of punching power and a lot of intrigue in that fight. Now then, Dana, you follow up this weekend with UFC 245, which includes three bouts and legends like Jose Aldo, Uriah Faber on the undercard. But I want to start with Amanda Nunes, the double champ. When you look at the run that she's been on as a champ since 2016, what kind of thoughts do you have about her?
GOAT. She's the GOAT, man. She is. And it's, if you look at not just who she beat, she beat every champion that we've ever had in the bantamweight division, and she beat every champ at 135 and every champ at 145. And she didn't just beat them; she viciously knocked them out, including, you know, one of the most feared fighters ever, in Chris Cyborg. You know, her knockout of Chris Cyborg is a record for the fastest knockout ever in that division.
Dana, the thing is, the beauty of your sport, it seems to me, and we've talked about it, nobody is unbeatable. Everybody is going to lose eventually, like everybody. But is Nunes maybe as dominant as it gets?
Yeah, and this is one of those fights where, you know, you have probably the greatest female fighter of all time taking on Jermaine Durandamay, the greatest kickboxer of all time. So if she can do that in this fight to her. I mean, there's just right now they got her ranked number 5 pound for pound. She needs to be in the top 3 pound for pound.
Dana White's joining us. Then you follow Nunes with Max Holloway defending his title against Alexander Volkanovski, who is on a 17-fight win streak. How big of a challenge is Holloway looking at?
Yeah, that fight's awesome. Volkanovski is an absolute beast. Holloway looks better every time he fights. That's a very, very fun fight.
We're talking to Dana White for a few more moments. And then you've got Volkanovski in the camp. They're very confident, especially after wins over Aldo and Chad Mendes. But how much deeper does the water get when you step in, though, Dana, with Max Holloway?
Yeah, Holloway's the man. If you look at how long this guy's been around, the fights, the win streak that guy's been on, his win streak was like 5 years. And 5 years of fighting all the baddest guys in the world. So getting through Max Holloway is no easy task.
Going rapid fire with Dana White, talking about these matchups. Then you've got Usman and Covington. As some people know, a few weeks back, Dana, Colby claimed that if he wins that fight and you try to put the belt on him, quote, I'm going to take that belt from him and slap him in the face with it. I mean, Dana, what was your reaction when you heard that?
Yeah, same as it always is when I hear things from Colby Covington. You know, he says a lot of stupid stuff. He better not, that's the last thing he better be worried about right now. I'm thinking about it. He needs to worry about Kamaru Usman, who hates him. These two hate each other. And stylistically, these guys match up perfectly. They have the exact same style. So this is going to be a hell of a fight, and Colby Covington should be worried about that, not whether I'm strapping the belt on him or not.
We're talking to Dana White. Dana, to that point, like if there are situations where maybe a fighter does not like you, or maybe you personally, just on a personal level, don't care much for a fighter, does that ever get in the way of setting up fights or you doing business?
No. I mean, I'd say the worst situation ever in the history of the company was Tito Ortiz and I. And I mean, he fought here for years while he and I went at it, you know? So we don't have to be best friends for you to be one of the best fighters in the world and thrive in the UFC.
Dana White joining me for a couple of more moments. And then, Dana, if that were not enough, there was a report last week that Conor McGregor has signed off to fight the Cowboy at UFC 246 on January 18th. Are there still any details that need to be worked out, or is that official?
No, it's official. Those guys are going to fight at 170 here in Vegas. And, you know, what Conor wants to do is he wants to get this fight under his belt. And if he beats Cowboy, he wants to turn around as quickly as possible and fight Khabib.
So, Danny, you and I have talked about Conor in the past. And you've mentioned that when you got $100 million in the bank, it's not always easy to get motivated to pay that price. He has not fought since he fought Eddie Alvarez in 2016. If you had to guess, how do you think Conor shows up for this fight?
Yeah, I think he's in phenomenal shape. You know, he's at the point in his career right now where a win is a must, and he's taking it very serious. We actually talked yesterday. You know, he's in great shape. He's ready to roll, and very excited about this fight.
All right, Dana, one last thing. You and Floyd Mayweather were next to each other at a Celtics-Clippers game recently. Floyd posts on Instagram, quote, Dana White and I are working together again to bring the world another spectacular event in 2020. So, Dana, is there anything that you would like to say about that?
Yeah, no, it's true. We sat at the Clippers game. We started talking, and we literally got a deal done right there on the court. Shook hands. We have a deal. And if things play out the way that Floyd and I think they will, then I will probably sit down with Al Haymon in, I would say, March. And get a deal on paper.
Huh. Any details, anything about that deal you want to share with me right now, Dana?
Not yet. Let's see how the next few months play out, and we could be doing something fun probably. I think if everything goes our way, Floyd and I would be doing something in October or November.
Mountain View, California. Greg in Mountain View. It's good to have you, Greg. How are you?
Jim, how are you? I listened to your show, first-time caller. Just wanted to reason with you and about Clay Helton.
Sure.
For the simple fact, their recruiting is 67th in the nation.
True.
The top 30 California recruits chosen to go elsewhere. The stadium is empty. They can't beat Texas. They can't beat Wisconsin. They can't beat Notre Dame. They can't beat Oregon. They lose to BYU. 8 wins against horrible teams is not USC football. It's not the tradition. And if they don't turn this around very quickly, it's going to be the death nail. So I just have a simple challenge to you. Peel the onion back a little bit. Have some in-depth research. Bring in some Trojan football former players and alumni to explain how horrible of a coach that Helton is. They don't hit in practice. They have all these injuries.
So in other words, Greg, you just said everything I said in my take. So I don't need to bring in anybody to explain to me the way things are. I laid all that out. I mentioned to you, he's not Pete Carroll. I mentioned to you, he's not the best coach ever. What I did say was, Clay Helton is a good guy and a good coach, but not a perfect coach. And I acknowledged literally everything you just said.
Good night now!